In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. On average, about 10% of children aren't the genetic offspring of their supposed biological fathers. That's one out of 10 people you may know. It could be almost a billion people worldwide. In 1996, Professor Robin Baker published the book Sperm Wars, The Science of Sex, and it essentially elaborates on sperm competition theory. If competition is heritable, females fertilized by the most competitive sperm will gain through the greater reproductive success of their sons. There are three categories of sperm: egg getters, killers, and blockers. A study in the UK showed that 4% of people are conceived through sperm warfare. This internal dynamic is known to drive subconscious behavior and shapes the sexuality of every man, woman, and child. The research behind these concepts that began in 1985 examined million-year-old programming coded into human biology. Some cultures condemn infidelity and masturbation. However, these acts have been found to be ancient strategic advantages towards successful human reproduction. We talk with Dr. Baker about his book, Sperm Wars, The Science of Sex, outlining 37 short stories of people engaged in many types of sexual behavior. As each story unfolds, the role of sperm competition is explained. Professor Robin Baker is an evolutionary biologist who authored nearly 100 scientific papers, 6 academic books, and is the author of 4 popular science books: Sperm Wars, Baby Wars, Sex in the Future, and Fragile Science. Professor Baker, welcome to Another News.
Well, it's nice to be part of your program. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, if you would tell listeners, what is a sperm war?
What is a sperm war? Right. Well, when a woman has sex, that's unprotected sex, no contraception, with 2 or more men, but let's say 2, in the 5 days leading up to the day that she produces an egg, then, of course, that woman is going to have sperm from both of those men inside her reproductive tract at the time that she does produce an egg. So inevitably, those sperm will then compete for the prize of fertilizing that egg. Now, that competition, although it's got elements of a lottery in that the man that produces, that has more sperm in there, is perhaps more likely to win, and it's got elements of a race in that there might be times during that competition that the man with the fastest sperm is more likely to win. More than anything, we think it's like a war. In other words, the two sets of ejaculates from the two different men are battling it out, trying to make sure that it's one of their man's sperm to fertilize the egg rather than the other man's sperm. That is the prize, that's the winner of the battles. So we call it sperm wars.
And sperm wars occur in other animals. Would you talk about that, please?
Does sperm wars occur in other animals? Absolutely. Yes, any female of any species that mates with more than one male when she's fertile will have sperm from more than one male inside her. And so those are going to compete just like they do in humans. In fact, sperm competition was first studied back in the 1970s for insects. That was where the first realization that this could be a very important part of the evolution of sexual behavior in animals as a whole. And almost as soon as it was pointed out, everyone said, yes, why hadn't we realized this before? And started looking at animal after animal. And to be honest, I don't think an animal has been found yet that doesn't, at least some individuals of which, don't end up with sperm from 2 males either inside them or being released in their vicinity, things like frogs. So yes, sperm competition occurs in all animals, and it particularly occurs in primates, of which humans are one, of course.
Professor Baker, you reference a British survey from the late 80s showing that in a lifetime, about 80% of women had sex with two different men within 5 days, 69% of women within 1 day, and 13% within an hour, and 1% of women had sex with two different men within 30 minutes. I can see how some religious groups and or women's groups may object to this type of research, but would you please talk about this in terms of reproduction success and sperm competition?
By the time the study of sperm competition in other animals, by the time we got to, say, the mid-80s, lots of people looking at lots of different animals were working on sperm competition. You'd go to conferences and people would be muttering and saying, do you think, what about humans? Do you think we could possibly do research on humans? And everybody seemed to think it was a good idea, but nobody could quite see how it could be done. But I was lucky enough in the mid-80s to have a student called Mark Bellis. He started off doing a medical degree and switched to zoology, so he knew a lot about how to handle human material. And he came up to me after one of my lectures talking about this and said, well, I think I can see how it can be done. And so we started a collaboration to actually try and apply what other people had been doing for other animals to humans. But the biggest stumbling block we had right at the beginning was that nobody had any idea how often sperm competition might occur in humans. I mean, of course, it had to occur sometimes. I mean, we knew through rape, through prostitution, but most of all through infidelity, that women did sometimes have sex with men, with more than one man, at the time that they might conceive. But the question was, how often was it? Did they do so often enough for it to be an important factor in human sexual behaviour? So we were lucky enough again to get the interest of a nationwide British magazine, woman's magazine, to allow us to take part through their pages to organise a survey to ask women all the detailed and fairly intimate questions that we needed to answer this question. And I think we were surprised, and I think a lot of people when we published it were surprised. But the sort of figures we got were that after a lifetime of sexual behaviour, we said, we put it at, say, 3,000 copulations, 3,000 acts of sex. We found that 80% of women had actually behaved in such that they'd had sex with two different men within 5 days. 69% actually said they'd had sex within 1 day, and 13% in an hour, and 1% even within 30 minutes. Of course, people do occasionally have threesomes and so on. And so this looked as though it was certainly common enough behaviour for sperm competition to occur often enough to be an important part of human sex.
Dr. Baker, would you please talk about the idea of how 10% of children are not sired by their supposed fathers, and how this is analogous to the cuckoo bird's behavior?
The cuckoldry rate, yes. The information that we got from the company magazine showing that women do have sex with more than one man in a short period of time was all very interesting and important, but it didn't answer the real question that an evolutionary biologist would need to know the answer to decide whether sperm competition was an important part of human sexual behaviour or not. The important question is how many children, what proportion of children are born as a result of sperm competition? In other words, what percentage of women have got sperm from more than one man inside them at the moment they conceive? Because a figure lower than, say, 1% would tell us that sperm competition probably isn't very important. But anything getting up to 5, 6 or so percent, anything above that, would suggest that sperm competition was important. So we looked for a way of trying to get this sort of information. Sperm competition in humans can arise from a number of different ways. For example, rape can sometimes result in sperm competition. Prostitution, of course, could result in sperm competition. Group sex results in sperm competition. But by far the most important route to sperm competition in humans, everybody's agreed, and the data would suggest this too, is infidelity. Because humans are largely monogamous, the woman usually has a partner of some sort, either a husband or a live-in partner. Society would expect to be the father of her children, but she also, women do also, as we all know, it's the source of all literature, from time to time take it, well, let's call him a lover. Not very biological, but let's call him a lover. So you can look to see how often a woman conceives to her lover rather than her long-term partner, because there's a very good chance that when she conceives to her lover, his sperm have been in competition with her partner's sperm, who has much more regular access to her. This situation has come to be called cuckoldry. The partner who ends up with a child that isn't his own to raise says that he's been cuckolded. And this is a reference to the behavior, not very precise, but it's a reference to the behavior of the cuckoo bird. I don't know how many people know, but the cuckoo bird, the female flies around looking for the nests of other birds. She lays an egg in that nest. When her young hatches, it shoves out all the young that the parent birds have put into that nest, and the parents end up raising the chick of the cuckoo rather than their own. So it's a cuckoo in the nest. The parents raise a child that isn't their own, and so in humans, a male partner who ends up raising a child that belongs to the lover is said to be cuckolded. It's an analogy to the cuckoo situation. Right, well, we realized quite early in our studies, if we could get a figure for what proportion of children don't belong to the man you'd expect them to, this would give us some sort of indication of the level of sperm competition. Now, not all conceptions to lovers are the result of sperm competition, but the majority probably are. And at the time, medical students were told in their books, when they were studying the inheritance of particular diseases, that they had to be careful because 1 in 10 children did not belong to the man who they expected it to. So following genetic lineages through this could be confounded by this. So they were told to beware that not all children belong to the person you'd expect them to, and about 1 in 10 didn't. Well, Mark Bellis and I looked into the source of this information, and to be honest, it wasn't very good. It was based on a whole series of anecdotes and some blood tests, which aren't very reliable ways of saying who could be the father of something. They can tell you who can't be the father of a child, but they can't tell you who is the father of the child. So we just took the 10% figure at the time and said, well, if 10% of children don't belong to the man you'd expect them to, that means that on 10 occasions out of every 100, the lover's sperm won sperm competition. Well, there will be another 10 occasions, of course, because assuming that the lover and the partner have 50-50 chance of their sperm winning, if there are only two of them inside the female, there will be another 10 occasions that the partner won despite the fact that there's sperm competition. It's just that you can't tell it because the partner has fathered the child. So it looks as though he's just fathered the child, which means that a 10% non-paternity, a 10% cuckoldry rate would equal a 20% sperm competition rate. So 10% would mean 20% of children. 10% cuckoldry would mean that 20% of children were conceived as a result of sperm competition. Well, since the mid-1980s, when we got this 10% figure, that paternity testing has come in based on DNA, good solid research, and nearly 100 studies are now available to look at, and they find quite a variation in level of, these are around the world, all continents, quite a level of variation has been found. Some studies find only 1% cuckoldry rates. Some studies find as many as 50% cuckoldry rates, which rather implies that all children are conceived as a result of sperm competition in those cultures. And if you take the average of all the studies that have been done, it still comes out round about 10%. So quite by accident, I think, that the people who taught their medical students the figures about 10% got it right, quite by accident. But it's enough. 10% cuckoldry, meaning 20% sperm competition for the production of children, is quite high enough for sperm competition to have played quite a major part in the evolution of human sexual behaviour.
Very interesting. As you've researched, infidelity can play an important role in reproductive success. Would you please talk about what is going on biologically and strategically for the woman who would have an affair, and is it the same subconscious driver for men having affairs?
Well, most of our research was concerned with trying to work out the details of sperm competition, having shown that it occurred quite often enough to be an evolutionary force. We wanted to know how it worked. Because always at the back of our mind was this question of, well, why does it occur at all? Why do women sometimes show the behaviour that leads them to have sperm from two men inside them? And why do men go along with this and take part in this sort of behaviour? The question of why it happened is, of course, a very interesting one. Before I answer it, though, I've got to emphasise one thing. Mark Bellis and I are evolutionary biologists. Our interest is in trying to explain why a particular behaviour in humans exists. How is it that men and women have the genes, the hormones, the behaviour that causes something to happen? How did that evolve? What led to it? In giving these explanations, it sometimes sounds as though we're condoning what's going on, sometimes as though we're criticising it. We're not doing either of those things. We are simply just trying to explain what happens. Sometimes the criticism levelled at evolutionary biologists is that they're condoning the behaviour they're talking about, some of which is quite antisocial, of course. But we're not. We're just trying to explain it. And in explaining behaviour, evolutionary biologists have a unit of measurement that we call reproductive success. We ask the question, does this particular piece of behaviour lead to an increase or a decrease in the person's reproductive success, the person who's showing this behaviour? Now, reproductive success sounds a bit strange, but what it means, it's simply a numbers question. It's a question of, does a behaviour lead to an increase in the number of children that a man or a woman will have, or a decrease? We are all of us that are alive today are the descendants of men and women in the past who reproduced. None of us are the descendants of people whose behaviour led them not to reproduce. The chances are, mathematically, that we are the descendants of people who reproduced most. The more people our ancestors, the more children our ancestors produced, the more likely we are to be one of those. So the more children a person has, the more descendants a person leaves, the better their behaviour will continue through evolutionary time. Now, we're not just talking about the number of children here. You see, it could be that it was a great-great-great-great-great ancestor that started the behaviour that showed a higher reproductive success. Sometimes you can get a greater reproductive success in terms of the number of grandchildren, great-grandchildren, whatever, by producing fewer children, just having looking after them better, or they're being in some way of some higher quality, so that they themselves reproduce more, leading to more descendants. So our question becomes, how does infidelity by the woman or the man and sperm competition lead to an increase in reproductive success or decrease, depending on how it goes? Another important thing is that something that favours the reproductive success of a woman doesn't necessarily favour the reproductive success of a man. So evolution is often at the same time causing women to behave in one way and men to behave in a different way that are in conflict to some extent. It's the old war of the sexes, you know. Their interests do not always coincide. So that's another factor we've got to bear in mind. And also, the evolution of infidelity is a slightly different question from the evolution of sperm competition. The answers aren't necessarily the same, though of course the two are linked. Nor is the answer the same for men or women. So for both men and women, the number of descendants they leave is a function of the quality, some combination of the quality and number of children that they produce. It's different for men and women. For men, the emphasis is on the number that they produce, because it's actually quite easy. No, it's not easy, but it's possible for a man to have huge numbers of children. The record is supposed to be 800 and something for one man in terms of number of children. Women can't have anything like that number, though the record is supposed to be about 60 with lots of triplets and twins involved. But even so, men can have a lot more children than women, and men tend to show behaviour that increases the number of children they produce rather than necessarily the quality of the children they produce. For women, it's the other way around, that because they are limited in the number of children they can produce, it's quite important that those few children that a woman does produce are of, let's call it, quality. Now, quality, of course, that's a loaded word. We don't mean brilliant in any way, except that they are going to be good at surviving and reproducing. All else isn't so important, except insofar as it affects survival and reproduction. So women tend to go for quality of children, men tend to go for number. And infidelity can be seen in that light. Because as far as a man is concerned, having sex with a woman that has already got a partner is just another opportunity to increase the number of children he can have. But for the woman, infidelity probably doesn't lead to an increase in the number of children she has. But it may affect the quality of the children she has, because the lover may have some qualities that her partner doesn't have. As a result of conceiving to this other man rather than her partner, she actually produces a child that is going to give her more grandchildren than if she'd had the child with a partner. All sexual behaviour has costs and benefits. We've been talking about the benefits so far, the increase in number of children a man can have as a result of infidelity, the increase in the quality of children a woman can have as a result of infidelity. But, of course, the more partners a man or a woman has, there are disadvantages as well. One of the most obvious is that they're more likely to contract sexually transmitted diseases. But also, of course, if the infidelity is discovered, they may lose the partner that they have got, and the children that the woman has may not receive as good care as they would have done if she hadn't been discovered. So there are losses to be gained from discovery as well, which is why there's an advantage to infidelity being secretive, an advantage in terms of reproduction to infidelity being secretive. So that's infidelity. Sperm competition is a slightly different thing. Sperm competition is never an advantage to a man, because he is, in effect, reducing the chances of his sperm fertilising a woman's egg by half, or more if there are more than two men involved. So most of men's behavior is aimed towards trying to stop sperm competition. They try to stop the woman they are going to have sex with, like their partner or even their mistress or lover. They try to stop them from producing a sperm competition scenario. They try to stop them from having sex with another man. But women, on the other hand, do have the potential of getting an advantage from sperm competition, because by putting the sperm and the whole ejaculates, the sperm from two men into competition inside her, she is more likely to be fertilized, her egg is more likely to be fertilized by the sperm from the man who has the most competitive sperm and ejaculate. So, and if that is passed on to her children, to her sons and grandsons and great-grandsons, if that competitive sperm ability is passed on to those, then she gains a reproductive advantage in the future. So there is an advantage to sperm competition to a woman, there can be, but no advantage to a man. Now, quality, of course, is another of these words that evolutionary biologists use quite freely. And to some people, it's got some very unpleasant connotations. It smacks of eugenics and genetic engineering and so on. We don't mean that. When we talk about the quality of a child, we are solely talking about its ability to survive through to adulthood, not to be susceptible to all sorts of fatal illnesses and so on, and also then to attract a partner and to be able to reproduce and produce grandchildren. That is the pure meaning of quality as far as an evolutionary biologist is concerned.
Professor Baker, would you please talk about what it was like to learn about the different types or morphs of sperm in mammals? Did you at that point know that if this was true with mammals, then the possibility exists in human sperm?
Different types of sperm, yes. We had many eureka moments during the course of our studies, moments when something suddenly made sense once we started thinking of it in terms of sperm competition. And these sperm morphs, the sperm morphs of human ejaculates, was one of them. Now, people probably don't realise what we mean by sperm morphs, but everybody's got a rough idea of what they think a human sperm looks like. It's this rather elegant thing with an oval-shaped head and a long, wavy tail, and they sort of shoot across the television screen or the field of view of a microscope, looking very athletic and very fit, all set to go and fertilise an egg. But when you look down a microscope, that isn't what you see at all. There are some sperm like that, of course, and slightly the majority. But there are an awful lot of sperm that look, well, lame. They look as though they couldn't do anything. There are some with big heads, some with tiny heads, some with no heads. There are some with two heads, two tails, short tails, coiled tails that are obviously not going anywhere. The sperm swimming around in circles instead of going in a straight line. It's incredible. They look sick. Not at all what you'd expect. And we call these different types of sperm morphs, different sperm morphs. Now, in fact, the existence of different types of sperm, these different morphs inside a single ejaculate, these are perfectly healthy, normal, fertile ejaculates. This isn't unusual. This isn't just in people that are infertile. This is the average fertile man produces this mixture of sperm. And it was known first for humans that these different morphs in an ejaculate existed. In fact, because it was first seen in humans, people did think that, well, maybe it's because people have too hot baths or they wear their pants too tight or something like that. But it was soon then discovered that that other animals have these different morphs too. A gorilla ejaculate, for example, looks very like a human. So it wasn't unique to humans. It was something, but it was first discovered in humans and then extended to other mammals. The main suggestion was, well, therefore, they're just mistakes. That making a sperm is actually a very difficult job, and men find it difficult, and so they make lots of mistakes and only get it right sort of 1% of the time. The rest are all weird and useless looking. Now, that doesn't make sense to an evolutionary biologist. Reproduction, fertilization is such an important part of any animal's life, humans included. If you're going to produce offspring, you would expect the one thing that had been honed almost to perfection would be the manufacture of sperm. And so we turned this question on its head and said, well, maybe these aren't mistakes. Maybe these different types of sperm actually have a job to do, and that job has something to do with sperm competition. Maybe it's sperm warfare. Maybe that some of these sperm have jobs to do to interfere with the sperm of some other male if they happen to come into contact with them inside a woman. And eventually we narrowed it down to there were perhaps three roles that the different types of sperm could do. Those that were lame and weren't going to go very far, we thought were most likely to perform as blockers. That is, they would get in narrow passages through the female cervix and block them. They'd settle down there. They could even die if they wanted. They would block passage to any sperm from another male through there. One of the jobs would be that there should be sperm that go through the female tract and fertilise the egg. We called these egg getters. The ones that just sit and block, we called blockers. But we thought the most important part could well be that there are sperm there that go around looking for sperm from another male and seek and destroy them. We eventually ended up calling these killer sperm. So there are these three jobs we postulated: blocking, killing, and egg getting. And this is why you have the different types of sperm. Each one has a job to do, and its morphology and behavior is suited to that job. This is an evolutionary explanation rather than a manufacturing explanation. And so our next job was to try and get evidence that these jobs existed.
Would you please tell listeners about the function of chemicals on the head of sperm?
Chemicals, yes. You see, whenever we first started talking about killer sperm, the immediate reaction was, well, that's crazy. How can sperm possibly kill each other? It's not the sort of thing you associate with sperm, is it? But in fact, that's a completely wrong impression of sperm. Sperm are actually very dangerous things to things their own size and even bigger. And the reason is that they carry around on their head a bag of very dangerous chemicals that are there for the egg getters and for the killer sperm, as I'll say. Those chemicals are there because in order to fertilize an egg, the sperm has got to dissolve its way through quite a lot of tissue that surrounds the human egg so that it can get at it. And those chemicals are really very powerful. It's like sperm are carrying around a bomb on their head. And there are photographs of human eggs with lots of sperm around them. You put too many sperm around a human egg, in vitro fertilization and so on, you have to be very careful not to put too many sperm around the egg, because if you put too many, these chemicals from too many sperm can actually dissolve the egg and kill it. And if they can do that to an egg, which is many, many, many times bigger than a sperm is, just imagine what they can do to another sperm. So yes, it sounds crazy that there could be sperm that are killers that go around killing other sperm, but it's perfectly feasible. The question was, do they? Well, we set about a series of experiments that we called mixing experiments to see if we could find any evidence for this. What we did was we got a lot of ejaculates from a lot of different men through the local IVF clinic that had sperm to spare. And we mixed sperm from one man with another man. We got rid of all the semen and all the seminal fluid and put them in liquid that mimicked the inside of the female. Put sperm from one man with another man. And we also, as controls, we mixed sperm from one man with his own sperm. Then we looked over different time intervals to see if we could find any evidence that there was more death going on or any sign of killing in those that were mixed ejaculates rather than from the same man ejaculates. And we did. Not immediately. The first 3 hours, for example, there was no sign of anything, any difference between the two sorts of mixes. But after 6 hours, and particularly after 12 hours, we found a much greater death rate when the sperm were from two different men than when they were sperm from the same man, which looked to us like evidence that sperm were doing something in there to kill each other. And the question was, how did they do it? Well, after a lot of looking, we realized that we kept coming across in the mixed sperm a lot more examples of sperm head to head. Usually one had its head sort of halfway along the head of the other and was seemed to be attached to it. And we followed some of these through, and sure enough, the one that looked as though it was being attacked was the one that died, and the other one swam off. We managed to get a bit of film of this too, which appeared on a television program. So we were excited and satisfied that there was evidence that sperm could kill each other because of these chemicals that they had on their head.
Professor Baker, would you please talk about what happens to the egg that prevents another sperm from entering it?
Right, yes. Well, people tend to think of sperm and egg as being collaborators, almost like a partnership. It is, after all, a sperm and an egg that produces a new human being. You tend to think of them collaborating to achieve this. But the reality isn't quite like that. Sperm are dangerous to eggs, as I've said, partly because of the chemicals that they produce on their head, but also because if more than one sperm enters the egg, so that there are two sperm inside the egg, then the egg can't develop. The extra set of DNA, of chromosomes, that goes in with that second sperm, it means that the egg can't develop. Everything goes haywire. It's not possible. It is only possible for the embryo to develop, for the egg to start dividing, if only one sperm goes into it. So there's a problem here. Now, it's partly solved by the female by killing off sperm as they go through her body. She does her utmost in terms of sending out white blood cells to eat up sperm and to make it difficult for them. She does her utmost to make sure that only two or three sperm ever get near to the egg at the same time. So that reduces the chances of getting lots of sperm around the egg, which chemicals they produce are dangerous to the egg. But also, the more sperm around the egg, the greater the chances are that more than one sperm will enter the egg at the same time. And this is so important that the egg has developed a set of reactions and defences that try to stop this from happening. So if two sperm do happen to arrive at the egg within seconds of each other, if one sperm starts to penetrate the egg, as soon as the head starts to get inside that outer membrane of the egg, immediate changes happen to the chemistry and thickness and so on of that outer membrane of the egg to try and stop any other sperm from getting inside at the same time as the first one. It's really fast and it's really effective. Sometimes it fails. Sometimes two sperm do get in at the same time and the egg won't be able to divide and dies and passes through the woman and doesn't implant. But most of the time, as long as there are only one or two sperm around the egg at any one time, the egg can stop more than one sperm entering.
Would you talk about how the warfare between two ejaculates of two men, or the threat of it, has shaped the sexuality of every man, woman, and child today?
Yes, well, at first sight, it might not seem a terribly important thing, the fact that sperm competition does occur, but the closer you look at it, the more you realize that just about every aspect of human sexuality has evolved as part of a response to the fact that sperm competition might occur. It goes back to two main factors that we've touched on lightly already. The first is that it's never an advantage to a man for his sperm to come into competition with another man's sperm inside a woman. It's always better for the man if his sperm have a completely free field inside the woman. They have a clear run through to the egg, because of course if there's sperm from other men there, his chances of fertilizing that egg are going to be reduced by half or more if there's sperm from more than two men there. So the threat of sperm competition has meant that there's been pressure on males to try and stop it from happening. So this has led to evolution producing males who guard the females, who are very possessive, very jealous. They do everything they can to stop a woman whom they're going to have sex with from having sex with anybody else. But of course, sometimes they fail. And the woman does have sex with two men at the critical time, which means that the man has got to have his ejaculate in a state of permanent readiness to be able to win any competition that might occur. So this means he has to be doing things inside his body to make sure that his army of sperm are as fit as they possibly can be. So if we dissect male sexual behaviour right from the mate guarding side of it, the feelings of jealousy and possessiveness that lead to mate guarding, and the extra alertness to other men's attention to a woman that he's planning on having sex with or is having sex with, right through to if he fails, even the shape of the penis has been shaped by the threat of sperm competition, because the penis is actually well designed to remove sperm from some other man, as it is to put more sperm in. And then it's really important that because there is this chance that he'll fail and he will enter into sperm competition, to making sure that his ejaculate is as fit as it possibly can be to try and win the competition that is about to occur. And as part of this, masturbation is part of this story, and so is the way that the sperm line up inside him and the different ages and so on. So all aspects of male sexuality can be linked to threat of sperm competition, and the same goes for females. Because she's going to gain an advantage from doing something that the male doesn't want her to do, there's been pressure on women to have that extra bit of guile, that extra ability to escape the male's attention on occasions that she's fertile, so she can have sex with another man, even to the extent that evolution has rid the woman completely of any advertisement of when she is fertile. Unlike some primates, which actually advertise when they're fertile by bright colorations and really, really flirty behavior, women don't advertise in anything like the same way. And this allows them, when they're fertile, to escape the attention of males, if she wants to. She won't always want to, of course, but if she does, it helps that they don't know that this is the critical time. And then also, if she does succeed in setting up sperm competition, it is often useful to her to be able to bias in some way which of the males she's had sex with might win that sperm competition. Putting them in competition is one thing, but her body may have a preference as to which of those males would win. And a woman has all sorts of ways of adjusting the numbers from each male inside her. This relates to orgasm patterns, it relates to masturbation, it relates to the way that her cervix works inside her, the structure of her cervical mucus. Just about every aspect of female sexual behavior is the result of evolution based on the threat of sperm competition.
Professor Baker, there are some insights about the worldwide prejudice and hypocrisy of male masturbation that listeners may not know about. Would you tell them about this, please, and the competitive benefits?
Yes, male masturbation is probably one of the most misunderstood and, in many ways, one of the more intriguing parts of male sexuality. It's absolutely normal part of male sexual behavior, not just humans, but other primates as well. We're all familiar with the sight of male chimpanzees standing there with an erection in front of females, masturbating. All men do it, virtually all men do it. And yet at the same time, the idea of doing it is used as a term of abuse and ridicule. And in some religions, of course, it's even been made a sin. But in fact, it is an important part of male sexuality. And in the context of sperm competition, masturbation is one of the mechanisms, maybe even the main mechanism, by which a man can make sure that when next he has sex with a woman, either his partner or somebody else, he produces the ejaculate that is best suited to the situation. Now, again, this idea might seem strange, that ejaculates can be suited to particular situations. But we can recognise two different sorts of ejaculates broadly. There's the defensive sort, which has sort of middle-aged to oldish sperm in it and is quite rich in blockers that are, once inside the female, are going to make it difficult for another male sperm to get through, so they're blocking passage through. It's a defensive type of ejaculate. There are egg getters in there too, and killers, of course, but it's biased towards defense. Or we can recognize an aggressive ejaculate, which is full of young sperm, heavily biased towards killers, not so many blockers, egg getters too, of course. These tend to be young sperm. You see, most commonly, a man in our current society, a man has sex with his partner, and then 2 or 3 days later, he has sex with the same woman, and then 2 or 3 days later, sex with the same woman. The frequency varies according to how long they've been together and how old they are, and so on. But as a rough average, we say every 2 or 3 days, we call it routine sex, sex with a partner at fairly regular intervals. Most of the time, sperm competition doesn't come into the equation, and the man just needs to put in a defensive ejaculate. He can put in an ejaculate that is a few days old. But suddenly, a man might have the possibility of having sex with a woman who, there's a very good chance of sperm competition there because she's somebody else's partner. And suddenly he finds himself needing a young ejaculate, an aggressive ejaculate that is going to perform well in sperm competition rather than just do the easy defensive bits. And the mechanism he can use to suddenly switch what was going to be an old defensive ejaculate into a young aggressive one is masturbation. By masturbating in advance of the sex with somebody else's partner or just some other woman who is likely to have sperm from another man inside her, by masturbating in advance, he can convert his old defensive ejaculate into a young aggressive one. And one of the more interesting things we found out in these studies was that a man who has just had sex with a woman who isn't his partner, he very frequently, I mean almost always, has masturbated about 12 hours before that sex, whereas normally the time interval between masturbation and sex is much longer. It's about 24 to 48 hours, depending on age, etc. It's as if the man is preparing his ejaculate for this act of sperm competition by masturbating and producing a young ejaculate.
As unpleasant as it might be for some listening, would you tell listeners what was learned about flowback and how that intentional pushing out of sperm was found to be important to successful reproduction strategy.
Flowback, yes, that was really was a second most exciting eureka moment, I think. Realizing the importance of this phenomenon. When Mark Bettis and I first started our work on human sperm competition, started our real work collecting sperm, sperm competition was still very much something that people thought of in male terms, the competition between sperm from two males. Lots of theories had been produced about the sort of things that might happen inside other animals. And one of the favorites was that in animals that had higher levels of sperm competition, more sperm, you would find that the males regularly put in more sperm than in animals that had less sperm competition. And by and large, this study in other animals had been found to be correct. The theory had been found to be correct. So we followed up this idea that everything was sort of male driven for our work on humans. People looked at it as if, yes, the female goes out and collects sperm from two different males, but then everything that happens inside her is male driven. It's what the males are doing, like the number of sperm they put in and so on. And we continued along this line when we first started, I have to admit. And our first real experiment was we got together a fair number of couples and asked them to collect sperm during intercourse for us. In other words, just don't throw away your condoms, give them to us, let us count the sperm that are in those condoms. And we'd ask them various questions and so on. And one of the questions that we asked was, how much time have you spent with each other since your last copulation, since the last time you had sex? Because our prediction would be that the less time they'd spent together, the less percentage of time they'd spent together, the greater the chance that the woman could have had sex with somebody else. So the risk of sperm competition was greater the less time the man had spent with her since his last copulation with her. And therefore, we would expect, our prediction was, that the man should inseminate more sperm during sex than if he'd spent nearly all his time with her between those copulations. And this was our first publication on the matter, and the theory was well supported. We did all the necessary controls and so on, and this was all really exciting. Men were obviously adjusting how many sperm they were putting into a woman, depending on what the risk of sperm competition was. And it was around about this time that a female colleague of ours said, well, I don't know why men are bothering to adjust the number of sperm that they put into a woman, because nearly all of it comes back out anyway, doesn't it? It suddenly clicked. You see, we'd been thinking everything was male-driven, but suddenly we had this possibility that the woman might actually be adjusting the numbers of sperm that she retained by getting rid of some of those that are inseminated into her. Now, most people know, we went on to call this the flowback. Most women are very aware of the flowback. It's the wet sheet phenomenon. It dribbles down the leg when you don't want it to. But the main ejection, the main loss of sperm occurs during the first urination after sex. And whereas the flowback had previously been thought of as something really passive, just something that happens. In fact, medically, it was a cause for some concern that this flowback occurred at all. Women worried that they were losing the sperm that they'd received and it would reduce their fertility in some way. But if you watch what happens when a woman urinates after sex, of course, the sperm is in the vagina, the urine comes out of the urethra. So they're coming out of two different places. When the woman first urinates after sex, you see these two things coming out with great force. The urine comes out near the front, and the semen comes out through the vagina, and you're left in absolutely no doubt that the woman is ejecting this. It's not a passive loss at all. She is ejecting this sperm. She's getting rid of some of the sperm. So our question to ourselves immediately was, well, how much is she losing? And does it vary at all? Because if it did vary, and it varied in accordance with things that she was doing, it meant that the woman, totally unconsciously, had some control over the number of sperm that she retained. So this colleague of ours set about finding ways of standardizing the collection of semen and the sperm it contained after intercourse. And because by then we had done enough experiments with the number of sperm that men inseminated during copulation, we could predict mathematically with sufficient accuracy just about how many sperm a man would put in on any given occasion if we had enough information. And if we then could collect the flowbacks and count how many sperm were in that, then by subtracting one from the other, we could work out how many sperm stayed in the woman. And lo and behold, we found that the number of sperm that comes out does vary quite a lot. It averages about 50%, let's say, just to make it easy. There's a lot more could be said, but let's say about 50%. And this is the material that comes out about 45 minutes after intercourse. But sometimes nearly all of the sperm come out. And if you collect flowback from pregnant women who have, where the sperm can't get through the cervix door, you find that that nearly all sperm come out. You can count as many coming out as you calculated went in. And we investigated what sort of things influence the number of sperm that a woman retained after intercourse. And we found that it ended up quite a complicated story, but it was affected by whether or not she had an orgasm during intercourse, whether she'd had an orgasm in the hours or days before intercourse, things like that. And it allowed us to work out the ways in which women were actually controlling how much sperm from intercourse to intercourse they were retaining.
Well, that's going to do it for the first part of this interview with Professor Robin Baker. On his book, Sperm Wars, The Science of Sex, Professor Baker, thank you so much for sharing your insight about your research and the work putting together this book, Sperm Wars. Also, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.